So what we want to do today is provide some definitions and theories of co-optation, talk about a continuum of community-engaged research. We have a national study that we want to briefly talk about, and then we really want to reflect on our own practices and co-optation within that, and to think, have us all really collectively think on strategies to maintain resistance. Could you do that? So.
Now you're making me nervous.
Oh, you want me to slow down?
Yeah.
We have so many slides.
No, okay. We don't. You know, it's okay.
Did you take them out?
Oh,
okay. Well, what's going to happen is, you know, we're going to get to a point where the time is over and we might not get to our questions.
Go, go, go.
Okay.
Just go.
Okay. So I want to give a nod to one of our wonderful doc students at the University of Washington, Morinai Benali, who's actually doing his dissertation on co-optation. And he shared a lot of his work with us, so I just am indebted to him. So here are various definitions of co-optation for us to consider. The process of absorbing new elements into the leadership or policy determining structure of an organization as a means of averting threats to its stability or existence. Another is a form of compromise. Is co-optation compromise? When faced with resistance, elites bend without breaking. I love this term. Take protest issues as their own. They appropriate the voice of the people that they're working with, and they absorb protest leaders into their own organization. Is that what we're doing? I mean, are we in APHA being absorbed? Anyway, definitions, a process of excluding dissenting parties from key agenda-setting positions. Absorbing includes exclusion as a means to eliminate threats to power. Co-optation is a suboptimal strategy for dissenters as a form of compromise between purity of our movement and dilution of our message. And intentional exclusion of threats to power from agenda setting results in an attenuated rebellion. And what is co-optation? I mean, what is co-optation against? Let's consider really what social movements have as their, you know, key goal: to challenge the practices, initiatives, or policies of more powerful social organizations or political movements. Social movements are trying to establish alternative institutions that are embedded within a context of supportive, reinforcing cultural environments. We're trying to take back control over key areas of academic, political, and economic life from government or corporate institutions, and we're trying to believe community-based institutions are a tonic or really support to true democracy. And this is just an example of, you know, co-optation. We see Coke owning Odwalla, and, you know, corporate appropriation of environmental green values produces a green ceremonial facade, but policy changes are rare. And we see that. We have, you know, corporate communication has absolutely appropriated our social policy process in the United States. You know, I just want to say that there's this month's edition of Critical Social Policy is all about corporate communication and its effect on social policy. And I think we should all read it and really learn, you know, what is influencing a social policy development and why no one wants to invest in the public sector anymore. So, here, I'll turn this over to you.
So because Bonnie and I are heavily involved in, as many people in this room are, in community-based participatory research, we wanted to look with the co-optation lens at our own work. So this is the definition that we love so much. Thank you, Kellogg, and the Kellogg Community Scholars Program for pulling this together. And we love it because we think it embodies not just the idea of collaborative relationships with partners, but recognizing strengths, not a problem definition or a needs assessment only, using the idea that, of course, we start with the needs, issues of the community, and it ends with, you know, improving for social change. That's what we're all about. So, but, you know, as we go along, the big question for us is, can this definition itself, the most social justice-oriented definition of all the ones that exist in CBPR out there, this one, even the definition, can it be co-opted? And we, of course, love a whole set of principles, recognizing community as a unit of identity and its collaborative and co-learning and support for action and research together. And then even those of us who've had the honor of working in tribal communities, recognizing the importance, the learning that comes from working with sovereign nations, and the fact that the data belongs to the tribe and that you have to have tribal government review and approval that, in fact, it's kind of an ethic that supersedes all of the IRB ethics that exist anyway in other communities of color and other underserved communities in the nation. However, even this alone, are we still appropriating data? Are we still somehow appropriating a set of, or scientizing, is there a verb around creating more scientific lens to view what's happening in communities versus a hybrid lens, even despite the core values of trust and respect and reciprocity? Which brings us back to some of the definitions. Are we absorbing, even with CBPR, what is happening in communities into our scientific world? And are we, in fact, creating a compromise and changing the dynamics in the community, taking on set of the protest issues? So I just have two slides of kind of my own, before I get there. There are historical origins of CBPR, one, of course, in the more US-based organization cycle of cycle reflection action that is not so much around social change, but just that there's a good cyclical process of learning and that you learn by action, you reflect on action, you learn by action. But of course, this has been co-opted by management circles that bring labor and management together in cooperative ways that don't, that kind of destroy the capacity of organizing into labor unions, et cetera, et cetera. So this kind of northern tradition is easily co-opted. But the southern tradition is what we hope and we draw from as inspiration and it's sort of the dream and kind of the what Makani raised is how do you keep some imagination, or in fact, Fran as well, an imagination into the future that really we look to our southern colleagues historically for in terms of radical critiques of social structural underdevelopment, et cetera, and challenged inequitable structures. So this is kind of a history that we draw from that keeps us, many of us, alive in CBPR that, you know, is reflected now in current discourse in terms of post-colonialism or colonialism or whichever version of oppression and looking at that. Go ahead. And if we look at CBPR now, we do have high variability for good, for NIH reasons and other reasons from CBPR that is really instilled targeting on communities to what is being manifested in, you know, people going and say, well, we're doing interventions in communities and we hope that we're moving to the end that is a more social justice end of CBPR with communities. We have just a few slides here on a grant that we have with Bonnie Duran and Sarah Hicks in the National Congress of American Indians Policy Research Center to actually study the variability of CBPR, acknowledging that this three-part on, in, with is happening all over the country. And it isn't just the CBPR at the end of what we see based in social justice even, and I'm gonna talk about that co-optation in a minute. But we had the grant itself is for specific aims to describe the variability across the country, describe the impact, particularly in academic issues of governance, look at associations between processes and outcomes. And if you're interested in the grant, we can talk about it later. But the idea is that there is variability in the country, and it's important that we raise the science of CBPR to understand the differences. We have looked at 400, we have seen when we did the analysis of 209 in 2009, we did this analysis of the report database of federally funded CBPR research, 407 projects. We'll be hopefully looking at 291, and they're funded by all institutes. What?
Look at the bottom.
I guess not.
This is a very collaborative process, of course. We do this all the time with each other. I'm sorry, dear. One of our colleagues at University of Washington, a student who's working with Bonnie as the senior advisor to this thesis, he looked at the abstracts of all these abstracts around the country, and only if, in terms of a textual analysis of the abstracts of funded NIH research, only 20% use the language of partnering. Others claim they all use CBPR in one form or another. They were funded in a variety of mechanisms. But they talked about more advising, more input, more, you know. So in fact, even within what is currently funded, we're finding that this is a, you'll see that. So in terms of our two slides on me, and then Bonnie will talk. This whole putting together this presentation made me extraordinarily uncomfortable. I've been doing this work for so long with a very strong family background of social justice, where I worked with Paulo Freire's ideas for decades and decades of trying to be inspired, and what does it mean to have, a community working on their own democratization and empowerment, and my experience with colleagues in Latin America and how important being involved in social movements and land movements and all of this is. That's the base of my work and what I've brought to my thinking here in my own CBPR research, but trying to say, okay, so how am I currently being co-opted? co-opted going towards the top of my leadership in my own academic institution, in this case in the University of New Mexico, co-opted even with my colleagues as I work with faculty of color and trying to support junior faculty and also work as colleagues with other senior colleagues, the faculty of color, and what does it mean in terms of my own institutional co-optation and what I'm doing, and then as am I co-opting communities? So I am currently the CTSA community engagement director in my institution. I've been kind of an outside marginalized person doing my own CBPR research, not marginalized only because I've been the director of the Masters in Public Health program and had access to leadership. But now that in this year, since the University of New Mexico has been invited into the Clinical Translational Science Center fold in July, I was invited to be the community engagement director. So now I am confronting this pull internally in my own heart of what does it mean to be trying to be responsive and be on the wonderful, in many cases, national phone calls of CTSA community engagement folks of over 100 people participating, many with very important solid social justice origins, but others with more of a what CTSAs came into this world from. It should go to the next slide. So obviously we now have in CBPR the challenge of, are we a social movement or are we being co-opted? And with the now term community engagement, we of course are facing on the extreme, one of the realities is that NIH is very interested in recruiting minorities into clinical trials, and they believe they haven't done it right yet, and the only way to do it right is to engage communities so that they will believe that they're not going to be abused anymore. So, and to develop more culturally sensitive interventions, because we know that we haven't been that successful in the community intervention world yet. I mean, it's very hard to be successful in community interventions, obviously, but if we make them more culturally sensitive, that kind of wording, will we have better science? And even the very, very important work of adapting evidence-based components into cultural embeddedness, it's really critically important. Even that, are we still imposing a certain evidence-based model on that without valuing first the community cultural embeddedness? So of course this is happening in multiple settings. It's happening in even the terminology community outreach and dissemination cores, which are not so much the bidirectional learning of community engagement, but they've started. I just wanted to say kind of in a couple ways I think of my potential co-optation and the struggle against it, upwards, middle, and down. Upwards in that, I have to respond to the NIH world. I'm now the community engagement director. And there are, in fact, in NIH now, there are going to be fewer RFAs that are particularly CBPR. They're integrating everything in it. I mean, it seems like that's the what's happening, so I'm worried that we're even going to lose our language. And there's, even with our own science, our wonderful, wonderful national research project where we get to look at CBPR nationally, are we, by making it science, even though we wanted to legitimize it, changing that it's no longer than just a social movement? Because historically, CBPR came out of the EJ movement, NIEHS came out of a real understanding that it was organizing, and there's wonderful, wonderful CBPR, both at the intervention level in small communities and working to really be embedded within the communities, and there's wonderful CBPR in terms of changing policies, massive attempts at really looking at structural change. But I'm just, our science lens on it makes me concerned about that. At the, kind of with my colleagues in the institution, I've been more aware, even in this meeting and in my own institutions, of the kind of microaggressions where people look to me as a, as this person to look to versus a faculty of color. I just watch this happening, and so I, how do I resist that, and how do I work against that, even though, you know, how can I be an ally? And that's, I think, what I'm going to lead to. But going, looking down, am I co-opting communities? I very much believe in the work that I do. I think I believe in it. But the, even as we embrace the idea in small communities where we encourage, and this is where I'm going to turn it over to Bonnie, that the fact we encourage the bringing in and the honoring of the indigenous traditions, cultures, beliefs, values that people want to bring to the interventions to really make them effective, I worry that we're bringing a lens to something that maybe should be left out of my knowledge. That maybe I shouldn't, you know, and how that gets, how that happens within the community. I'm always an outsider to those communities. I would never, even if I have long, long-term relationships with, which I do, but that's some, so I even wonder about the expectation, once you engage in partnership, what are we doing to the indigenous knowledge and the healing that comes from within that is bringing it into now an NIH frame.
So. How new is that an insight for you?
Okay, so, she'll say the real thing of what I'm worried about.
No, well, I wanted to talk about my, you know, my background and the context that I'm bringing to this. Nina talked about her, you know, very wonderful upbringing within a family of public intellectuals that were really had a social justice frame, and her work with Paulo Freire. You know, she was able to work with him directly and be mentored by him. And this is where I come out of. You know, I come from a very different social class than her. You know, my indigenous friends and I and other people of color say that a lot of our wonderful ally colleagues had to go this far between their social class and academia, and a lot of us have to go this far. And so I see a lot of nodding heads in the audience, and I know those people who are from backgrounds like that can totally understand. So what I wanted to say is this is my, this is where I come from. And, you know, so this is Linda Smith, who is a wonderful Maori researcher from New Zealand, and she's a wonderful colleague. We have a research center at the University of Washington called the Indigenous Wellness Research Institute, headed by Karina Walters, our wonderful, beloved colleague. And this is Linda's, you know, what she is preaching and what we are understanding and embracing about research. That research once was a tool of colonization, and I'll give you one of, you know, huge amount of examples that we have. But now we can, rather than just eschewing research and say, no, we're not going to do it, we're going to reclaim research. Because, you know, all of our communities of color have had indigenous public health, indigenous science forever. In fact, a new article that I have, if anybody emails, I'll send it to you. The title of it is When Science Became Western. Because, you know, science has been all over the globe. So anyway, so, you know, Linda and all of us are really trying to reclaim science in order to find solutions to the negative impacts of colonialism and to give voice to an alternative way of knowing and being. That's really what we're trying to do. And this is just one example. This is the context of which people of color, you know, other marginalized communities, LGBTQ communities, poor white communities, this is what public health has been historically to us. Public health and research has been a regulatory process for us. It has essentially tried to assimilate us into, you know, being able to work a 9-to-5 job and, you know, do the corporate bit so people could benefit from our labor. But anyway, so this, you know, this is the context of what our research center and our colleagues are coming from, is that historically public health has been about regulating native bodies and native space. And so this is where we're coming from. And, you know, what we're trying to do actually, you know, Makani talked about what is the space that isn't from a place of being oppressed, and for us it looks like indigenous knowledge development. And I don't, you know, here I want to cast a broad net to indigenous. It doesn't just include native communities, it includes any communities that have a you know, a post-colonial or approach to their own knowledge development and want to really embrace their own knowledge and their knowledge development methodologies particularly. So, you know, we have in Indian country, we have wonderful examples of resistance to public health regulation. You know, Handsome Lake, Tenskwatawa, the Native American Church were all movements in part against how colonial American discourse tried to invent Native people as alcohol and unreasonable and not, you know, bring them into the whole democratic discourse. You know, and nowadays what we have a new wellness movement, the new wellness temperance movement that is galvanizing intellectual, galvanizing indigenous knowledge as an intellectual organizing principle for us all to come together and work outside, you know. A lot of us want to work outside of the gaze of Western science because we don't know what that gaze is going to do to us. So, and this is what my versus is. You know, Nina talked about the CTSA work, and this is my versus, you know, my conundrum and my area that I feel like I'm being co-opted. And that is that on the one side, you know, the research work that we're doing with the National Congress of American Indians, and actually I'm doing, probably the number one worry that I have is I'm doing this wonderful NIDA-funded project with the tribal colleges. There's 36 tribal colleges in the United States, in the most rural places, the most, you know, what we would consider most underdeveloped places in the United States. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to say this, you know, the leaders of the tribal colleges, the college presidents, are really the ideological leaders of indigenous knowledge development in the United States. They work outside the gaze of Western. In fact, they had an edition of the Tribal College Journal just a couple months ago, and the theme of the journal is, should we publish in mainstream journals? And I'm going to tell you that one of the most influential presidents of the tribal colleges is actually one we work closely with at Northwest Indian College, Cheryl Crazy Bull. And you know what? Routinely, the board of the American Indian Higher Education Consortium calls our mainstream colleges, our mainstream universities, they refer to them as enemy institutions. And, you know, but in a good way. In a good way, in that they totally will embrace what we have to offer, but they know that, you know, they have something going on there that should not be colonized, should not be co-opted into what, you know, the knowledge development that we're trying to do. And I only have 3 minutes. So actually, we're right on time, I guess. Yeah, these are the questions. So, you know, Nina and I actually had a really interesting time developing this presentation. It was actually quite contentious. But we have come to, you know, agree that these are really the questions that we would like to bring to this group and really just to discuss how we're all being co-opted. So these are questions that we'd like to share with you for us to reflect on our own practice. Where are we getting co-opted? So do you want to say them or? Okay, so the questions are, what is the ideological context of Western scholarship and CBPR, and how does it replicate colonial relationships? And how do we as academics not co-opt indigenous knowledge as we incorporate elements into health interventions? And then, and you know, by this we don't just mean indigenous knowledge as native, it's indigenous knowledge to the communities that we live in. And where do we as academics not tread? Where do we not gaze? And how do we respect autonomy? So you do the other. Oh, go
ahead. Well, this is again going back to the idea of reflective practice, which I think has been embedded in all of our presentations. But how can communities of color, other disenfranchised groups, and their allies, those of us in academic institutions, use CBPR to achieve those goals of health and social equity and undo the legacies of historical oppression? And then how do we individually maintain our own integrity? I guess that's the question. And what are the opportunities for resistance? And as allies, how do we do it? In alliance with whom? So we want to throw open those questions from us. And of course, they embody some of the questions. Maybe everybody, Fran and Makani, should come up here.
Well, first, can we say,
thank you. Was it more?
Yes, okay.
Actually, maybe we could, can we turn the lights on so that people can see each other? Since we're not going to be doing slides anymore. Was there a switch up? Okay, well, somebody did it. I think these questions that Nina and Bonnie asked are a good start. I also want to pose just some of the tensions that I've been seeing in these talks. The first is between kind of, you know, social and individual, and you know how there are huge external pressures that take us to doing individual approaches, whether or not that's our original goal. So I want to appreciate and repeat that. And the other one is this tension that I think we have between legitimation and inclusion. Because often, if you're doing work that's kind of outside the mainstream, legitimation is how you can maintain that work. But at the same time, the reward for legitimation is often exclusion. If you keep people out, you can continue to be legitimated. So I want to throw those two things out as well. So are there any questions or comments at this point? Yeah, in the back. Want to say something?
You know you do.
I don't know.
I'm just watching that.
Well, I would just like to say that I think that, to be honest with you, I think that's a little bit of an apologist approach. And I think that, you know, that's the dominant paradigm. That's what we get every day. That's the waters that we swim in. And we're trying to create a little bit of alternative space right here. So I just need to say that. You know, I think that there's a place for other ways of knowing and being to be important and legitimated and honored. And of course the Enlightenment is important, but the Enlightenment is absolutely not just a Western tradition. You know, it is a tradition of all peoples who've made it thus far. And for you to characterize it as that is really, you know, it's not a very progressive ally thing to do. And I think it's really important, you know, one thing that I have noticed at this, you know, meeting is that, you know, I have so many wonderful white allies, and somebody needs to write about what it means to be a white ally, man, because people are not really getting that. And I know you absolutely mean well, and I know that you're wanting to, you know, reduce the suffering of people, and I'm sure, you know, that's one way of doing it, but that's not the way that I would support to choose to support right now to do it.
Because I have on high heel shoes. But you know, I do want to sort of pull the camera lens back on this and say that part of what happens when you don't understand or you don't know, but when the patterns of privilege and our understanding of how white supremacy as a system works is not visible, you can't help but move into this framework. You know, it's, you know, because it's from when we start as little kids, right? It's how you learn history. It's how you learn everything. And so we're in this context, and now we're trying to break free because so much of what we're dealing with is about the system of white supremacy and patriarchy, right? That explains so much, but it's rendered completely invisible in how we understand and learn things. And so you can just imagine for a minute, what it would mean. For example, as many folks have said, if we learned history from the West Coast to the East Coast, just a simple thing like that. You know, you'd understand history more as a horror movie than maybe like some galloping, you know, heroic thing. And I think part of what we have to sort of figure out collectively, those of us who are progressive, is not only talk about what it means to be a white ally, but what does white supremacy as a system and patriarchy as a system, if we make it visible, what does it mean to our work? What does it mean to the present day? And in how it even defines what is knowledge and what is just sort of commonplace wisdom or common sense. So I just...
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to take one here. Like, yeah, Mary.
Well, I have a question that's a little off this topic.
Oh, no.
If there are other people who want to pursue, this is what I often wonder about, people who engage in community-based research or and the whole concept of partnership with communities when you work in health. When you go to communities, they're often not thinking about health. I remember talking to a class of third graders, and I said to a little girl, "What can you do to be healthy?" That's what I was talking to the class about. And she said, "Get an education." Out of the mouths of babies. Or if you go and talk more generally, as a colleague from Bolivia said, and I don't know whether he's here, people are interested in jobs. They're worried about whether they're going to get jobs. So that very quickly takes those of us who work in public health into arenas where we don't work, really. And I just wonder, how you incorporate that. When people's first priorities are to get education and get jobs, and your interest is to talk to them about tobacco cessation.
I think that if you, in working with communities, I mean, I think that's exactly people recognizing that the social determinants of their health. I mean, and that's very powerful, and I suppose the trick is not dismissing that, you know, and saying, oh, well, actually, we've got a pamphlet here about not smoking. It's actually, you know, working with people in a deep listening way about that's what their health's about, and then seeing what kind of organisation that gives rise to. But I mean, what happens so much of the time in those conversations is that health workers go to communities and have their own agenda, and they're not actually listening to, that's why I think most often people in the community have a pretty good idea of the social determinants of health, because they know what makes them sick and what makes them feel good and all those sorts of things. So I wouldn't see that as a problem. I'd see that as part of, I mean, the problem becomes if the health service is saying, well, you can only work on directly on tobacco, and that's where an individual can't do much about that. But, you know, if you've got a health service that's saying, okay, we're developing a sort of healthy communities project, we're going to work, you know, we're going to look at that, we're going to look at education, we're going to look at jobs, we're going to think about what we can do about that. But I think it's very hard just to say any individual health worker can do that if they don't have organizational support for that. So, I don't know. Can I just make one comment about the other thing was just, I think in terms of the Indigenous health research, I mean, I do quite a lot of research with Indigenous colleagues, and what makes that okay for me is that I do it through a group that is, you know, is controlled and run by Indigenous people, and you're only there on the terms of the Indigenous people, and if you get it wrong, you get told, but at least you get told. So for me, that's the important thing, you know.
Does anybody want to speak to that? The question that was asked first, before we wrap that. Do you, Nancy? Oh, okay. Then I'm just gonna. Would you like to go? Yeah, please.
So thank you for your presentation. I just, you know, when I'm thinking about this question of co-optation and public health, I can't help but wonder how we might learn from other colleagues in other fields. I'm thinking specifically the struggles with American Indian populations, thinking about the co-optation of religion and philosophy, like something along those lines. And you know, or even talking about how cultural competency is sometimes taught to medical students and to medical providers in a way that actually perpetuates stereotypes, you know?
Right.
And so I feel like we can learn about that from those fields. But then I also want to add one more piece to this dilemma up here, and maybe some of you in the audience can actually relate to this. So my experience of being, you know, daughter of agricultural workers, poor family, but now very educated, you know? I have a doctorate degree from Stanford. I work in a public health department. I do academic research. But yet in my own community, and I do that work in my community because I'm committed to it. But I have to be very cautious about how I get marketed too.
Yeah.
Because I know that person in between. And I think we have to think about, again, from our other disciplines, of like, can the subaltern speak? Can the subaltern speak? Exactly! Exactly right!
That is, you
know, think about those post-colonial spirits.
Can the subaltern speak?
That's right.
Excuse me.
What is my position and what is my role? And I can see that some of you can relate to those.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So then the question becomes, you know, have I been,
I need to say something,
whitewashed,
I knew that,
and co-opted? And
that's right.
Do I become that same person now that, you know, now I have to speak for an entire population? But then how that also might get used against me. Well, look, you made it out given all your various barriers. Why can't other people make it out too? You know, so it's an open situation sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just another aspect of this that